Girls O' Mine, you know you had a good time when you're still feeling the after effects 2 days later. I attended a bachelorette party this past weekend, which included visits to a brewery and 2 clubs, driven in a limo bus with a string of blue-colored black lights. Yes, we wondered where the pole was. It was that kind of bus. Didn't stop us from swinging off the handle safety bars, though, dancing to the music a friend brought via her iPod. One of my brothers played a lot of air guitar in his younger years. Too bad we didn't have smartphones back then. It would have been fun to watch old videos of him in action. He actually has a band now. Guitars are played in a plethora of musical genres. Rock, classical, country, flamenco. Dave Lynch of Guitar Workshop Enterprises plays and repairs guitars and teaches folk how to play them. And he's an inventor. His first band was the psychedelic Chromachrome Orange Marshmallow Menagerie. Here's Dave. So my parents rented a guitar for me when I was maybe 10, 11 years old.
Right.
And I got as far as Frankie and Johnny. And then I just became, because I didn't have any, nobody was teaching me
right
how to play it. And all I had was this book, and I got
right
impatient.
Right.
Because I didn't understand. I hit that wall, and then I just stopped.
Did you have the recordings, or did you see them on television, or?
No, it's just a book. They just, at the local movie store, it was just a basic, very
right
simple notes, uh-huh, like a piano.
Right.
To teach yourself, because I could play basic piano.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought, oh, maybe she could do this, because
mm-hmm
she clearly loves music.
Right.
But when you're 10 years old and you're antsy and need to be on the go,
mm-hmm,
and you can't learn it right away and nobody
right
is showing you how.
Right.
So I've regretted that ever since. And now I would just be a wimp because it would hurt my fingers.
Not necessarily.
Really?
Yes, because learning the guitar is a long process. And it takes the same amount of time for an adult to do it as it does for a kid. Except when you're a kid, you don't have this perspective of time. You don't have this expectancy that, you know, that I need to be this good this fast. You just play with it.
And that's true. That's a
right
good point.
Right. So you just approach it, because learning the guitar, I mean, if you stop thinking about the destination, the adventure of learning the guitar is really a lot more fun than I'm going to be this good in 3, you know, you just have to put that aside.
Now, you've been at it for quite a while.
Yeah, quite a long time. Actually, the first guitar I got was a little plastic guitar my Uncle Vincent gave me when I was 6. And I tried to tune it to this song, Secret Agent Man.
Oh, nice.
Right?
Now that song's going to be stuck in my
right
head.
Exactly. That song was trapped in my head. I loved, you know, I would sit in front of the TV and listen to all, you know, Flintstones and Outer Limits and, you know, Lost in Space and the Jetsons. And then it was Rocky and Bull. And, you know, I tried to figure out all the songs.
Nice.
Right? And then the Monkees came on TV. Oh, my gosh. That wrecked me. I wanted those guys to look like they had a car, and they had cool shirts, and they had amplifiers, and they always seemed to have a good time. So I got sucked into music that way. And my mom played piano.
Yeah,
so
oh, that helps.
There was always music in the house.
And what kind of records did they play?
Well, my dad didn't really play any of the records. My dad was the business guy, you know. But mom, she taught piano, and her mom taught piano. And my grandfather, who I didn't really know, he was a violinist, and they played together. But mom always played both jazz and bossa nova stuff and the classics. You know, she really liked Rachmaninoff and Chopin and Franz Liszt and those kinds of players. But she loved, like, a lot of the classic jazz tunes. Like, she played the tune Laura constantly. That was her favorite song, you know. But there was other stuff, and so there was a lot of, especially that bossa nova, Latin salsa groove kind
blame
of stuff.
It on the bossa nova.
Oh, right. That was her house cleaning music. And so, you know, she'd put this on, knock back a glass of red wine, and she'd be, you know,
she's good to go.
Good to go. You know, she's doing the house, and I'm, you know, in the back going, wow, there she goes. You know, she's on her thing. You know, and I'd sit in my room, and but I had gotten sucked into, the, you know, the early rock and roll of the day, which was, it was the Monkees, and then it was the Beatles, and there was another weird, I don't know how, I ended up with a Harper's Bazaar record.
Oh, how funny.
Okay, and so then I had a brief fling with the saxophone, and of course,
little sax in your life.
I had to play a little sax as a young man. I had as much sax as I could handle. For some reason, I bludgeoned Winchester Cathedral to death, you know, and everybody hated it. They begged me to stop. So did you keep going with guitar? I mean, did you stop playing?
I truly did. But my brothers picked it up. My middle brother, and this is, I don't know where we picked it up. I think our grandfather, maternal grandfather's a perfectionist.
Right.
He would build things by hand, including his home. He just taught himself. He worked at the mill and would interview all the construction workers in the neighborhood.
Right.
And that kind of passed down to us. And so I made the mistake, unknowingly, of saying, oh, you need to learn the opening bit of Stairway to Heaven.
Of course.
This is like when I was in high school, right?
Right. That's an easy one, sure.
And he couldn't do it exactly the same, and he beat himself up and stopped playing. And I felt horrible about that.
Not everybody can be Jimmy Page. I know. You know what I mean? That's like
I didn't realize. I thought I just wanted to give him like a bar to just something fun to. But my other brother, actually, he's kind of started his own little band. He does the opening riff for my podcast.
Right.
And he just does it for fun.
Sure.
You know, of course, but that's his outlet.
Yeah, I heard the solid body distorted guitar thing at the beginning.
Yeah, he was just doing it on the spot. It was just kind of, because initially I said, well, it's conversations, accessories. Maybe I should have something kind of low-key and then spiked, you know, for the accessories, kind of symbolic.
Right.
But I couldn't quite, and I said, you know, I really want something a little more interesting. He says, oh, you mean like, thank you for coming!
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So he just kind of did that impromptu, and I said, it's good enough for me.
Right, right. It sounds very punk, actually.
I know, it's great.
It's got a little bit of a Clash vibe to it or something.
But I always regretted stopping the learning process for the guitar. But I've noticed, and you probably have as well, that when you, whether it's music or sports, you appreciate someone who has a high quality of expertise or a knowledge or an ability to play or participate in something because you have entered that arena yourself.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, it's interesting how that all that came about, because when I was young, like you were, the guitar that I did finally get, like an electric guitar made of wood, an actual instrument, this one that's up there on the wall. And I attacked the Beatles Revolver album. I just got sucked in by Day Tripper and Your Bird Can Sing and Tomorrow Never Knows and all those tunes. You know, it just sounded so interesting to me. And so I went about trying to figure it out by ear. I was going to figure out how that album worked, how they did it on the guitar. And I'd had a couple of guitar lessons. My mother had signed me up with a local music shop, and the guy that taught guitar in that store was an elderly gentleman with a big shock of white hair and a suit, but he played classical guitar. So when I walked in that lesson room as a young man with I was proud that I had this cool looking 3-pickup electric guitar with switches and everything. I thought this was the coolest thing going. He didn't like it. He thought it was junk. He said, oh, that's not a real guitar. And so I was immediately set back in my chair, and then really he wanted to teach me classical music. And all these fingering things, and this wasn't even close to where I wanted to go. I said, I want to learn how to play Beatles tunes. He was like, oh, so you don't want to learn that. And so I learned how to tune it, and I learned a couple of notes on the fingerboard, and that was it, and I was out of there. And so I pursued on my own how to figure out how to play that album. But there was another obstacle, and that was the physical difficulty of the guitar. And a lot of people, like yourself included, will get a guitar of unknown origin. Sometimes we call them GSOs here in the shop, guitar-shaped objects. They look like a guitar, but you can't play them. You can't squeeze the strings down for anything. You know, it doesn't matter how hard you try or how good you are. You just can't play the guitar because it's just impossible. So that was one of the problems I had with my first electric guitar. The strings were really high, and at that time, guitar strings were medium gauge and heavier. They were thick cables. You know, that's the way guitar strings. There was no such thing as like what I have on the wall in my shop here, super slinky and nines and all this sort of thing. That didn't exist back then. So it was purely by chance that one of my friends, a young man named John Laporta, actually, he and another guitarist named Keith, I don't know, I remember these guys, Keith Factor, we had a trio. We knew three songs. I think I was 11 or something, or maybe 12. We were riding our bikes through the neighborhood, and we heard a local band playing, a band playing in the garage of one of the houses. This is in Deer Park on Long Island, okay? Summertime, there's no school. And there's this band cranking through the garage. We're like, oh my God, there's a band in town. So we pulled up next to the house and we're listening to them cranking away. It was really loud. And we were talking to each other kind of loud over the noise, and they stopped and we were still yapping. And we were like, oops, I think we got busted. And the garage door rolls up. And so there are these older kids, you know, they're like 17, 18 years old probably, you know? And so we were just like, wow, we're so sorry. We didn't mean to, like, you know, we weren't trying to sneak into your house or anything, but we play too, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, I talked the kid with the guitar into letting me try it, and it was a Telecaster. Mm. And apparently, I guess his dad played banjo.
Oh, nice.
And his dad had put banjo strings on the guitar, which were much thinner than guitar strings. And this guitar was so easy to play, I was shocked. I could not believe it. It just physically was so easy to press the strings down, and I could move them around, and I could play the chords that I was trying to play. Immediately, I got it in my head that if I modified the guitar that I had to make it play like this one, that I could accomplish what I was trying to do. So as soon as I got home, I just got into Dad's toolbox, got the files out, and I started hacking away on my guitar, you know. And 44 years later, here I am doing the exact same thing.
But for other people
But for other people as well. You know, I kind of got good at it. I got to be tool guy.
Now you travel a lot with your music.
I don't travel as much as I used to, because the business has me here all the time. But, you know, for a while I was a road rep for St. Louis Music. I was the Crate and Ampeg rep, and I was all over California, Northern Nevada. And when I was working at Andy Penn's Drum and Guitar City years back, my jazz fusion group, the Dave Lynch Group, we had just released a CD called Blind Date, and we were getting airplay in Redding and KVMR and KDVS all over Northern California. And so we were playing, you know, all over the coast in the Bay Area and down to Fresno and Bakersfield, and we're starting to stretch out a little bit, but we couldn't make a lot of money at it. It's jazz, you know. So I had to, you know, kind of go back to doing the work gig. So, but anyways, all of this, I mean, this shop has been here for 18 years now, almost 18 years. It'll be 18 this September. And I've been fixing guitars in Sacramento for 38 years.
Well, I was wondering, in both your shop and your travels, meeting other musicians, did you ever experience guitar envy?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I was a younger player, I did, you know, and I'd go see, I remember seeing Mike Bloomfield, and he had a beautiful 1959 flame top Gibson Les Paul, you know. Yeah, I had guitar envy because I wanted that, you know. One of my guitar heroes, he died actually before I even found out about his band, Dwayne Allman. He played a beautiful Les Paul. And I ultimately ended up with several Les Pauls. I have one now. I have a 60 classic reissue made in 94. Beautiful. Actually, I have it here. It's gorgeous. And I'm going to play it tonight, actually. I'm playing at Etteray's on Fair Oaks Boulevard with the blues band, The Stuff.
Oh.
You know, we have gigs booked out. You know, these guys, we used to play together 15 years ago, and then we got busy doing other stuff. And this is Dr. Rock, Larry Bernstein, our amp repair tech, plays bass and sings, unfortunately. But that's what
I didn't say well, but he sings.
I didn't say well. He does sing, yes. But it's charming because it's so weird and endearing. Bob Mariano on guitar, and Bob's a great singer. He just whips it out there. And Tony Day on drums, and Tony's just a phenomenal drummer. And so somebody called Larry up and said, hey, you guys want to get together again? We're like, So Larry called us up. He goes, yeah, it's been a few years. You guys want to do another gig? We said, sure. Well, we did that, and that turned into 17 or 18 more gigs. So we're going to be out on the patio tonight at 7:30, just playing old Stones tunes and some blues tunes and a J.J. Cale tune. And we're going to do a couple of Allman Brothers tunes. Maybe, I play slide and, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And so we play really low key because it's dinner, you know, it's the patio. We got to be careful out there. So we don't. but I still play actively a lot. I still have the Jazz Fusion group, and I do guitar repair here in Sacramento. I got to Sacramento in 76, and I was very fortunate to get connected with a guy named Gary Cooper, who had come into Sacramento from the Bay Area. He had, when he had gotten out of the Air Force studying electronics, he talked his way into a gig with a company called Alembic, which he built custom exotic guitars, and they taught him how to build guitars. And I came into Sacramento not far out of high school, and I was the wood shop guy in school, and I learned everything about woods. And then a brief stay in Salt Lake City, where I worked in a cabinet shop and learned about heavy machinery and raw wood processing and handling and milling. And so when I met Gary, I was 20. And I convinced him that I was going to be the best guitar tech he'd ever had. I was going to do that, you know. He says, well, okay, you know how to use power tools and machinery. You run my power tools and cut my raw lumber, and I'll teach you how to fix guitar. And so, you know, I learned how to do a lot of this from him. And so we lost Gary several years ago in a car accident, unfortunately. Tragically, but I still use a lot of the techniques and have developed techniques of my own over the years, and I help try to keep local Sacramento artists in business.
What are some of the challenges that you've encountered with some of the instruments that have come through here?
The hardest part is trying to find a balance between economically viable and keeping someone's instrument that they like around, you know? If you look at the cost of labor for dental work, or automotive repair. I mean, if you get a dent in the fender of your car and the finish needs to be repaired, that's going to be, you know, $1,500 to $3,000 minimum. That's what it costs. To do the same amount of work on a damaged guitar, you know, there's a dent in the top or a chip in the finish or something like that, there's no way you can charge that kind of money because the guitar is only worth $400. You know, so we have to figure out how to cost effectively get people's guitars working. You know, like for example, if the frets wear out on an expensive guitar, even a guitar that's $2,000, the labor intensity required to replace all that fretwork, all the little bars on the fingerboard, mill it, polish it, set it up and dial it in, is not much different than setting braces inside someone's mouth for a dentist, okay, which is, you know, $2,200 or something like that. But that fret job, the most I can charge is $350-$400. So there's a huge different scale of what is a possible labor-wise to sustain a business like this, because my overhead is the same as the dentist's. The rent is the same as the dentist's. The security is the same. The telephone is the same. The advertising is the same. So we have to offer these services so that the local musicians can afford to keep their instruments going, and we can sustain what we're doing at the same time. So finding that balance is tough. That's probably the biggest challenge.
Do you think that's why the numbers of guitar repair folk are dwindling?
There's that, and there's also the fact that America, unfortunately, doesn't really value music education, and we have fewer musicians. So think about an era in the 40s and the 50s, 30s, 40s, 50s, early 60s maybe, when all your broadcast television shows and all your movie houses and all your dance halls all had live musicians. When people went out, people went out to get together. If you wanted to socialize, we didn't use an application. We'd meet at a dance hall where, you know, all your friends were. You'd talk about what was going on, and there'd be a band. Glenn Miller and
the Dorsey Brothers.
The Dorsey Brothers, right. And Charlie Parker and that was that kind of activity. And to be a professional musician you were very well respected, and the better you got, you know, Buddy Rich's band was another, Louis Belson and all those guys. You could have a very good life as a musician. Every film had to have musicians and composers. There were office buildings filled with musicians, you know, for jingles and commercials and TV shows and radio spots. That isn't the case anymore. In fact, there isn't even a workers' compensation code for musician.
Really?
Yeah, there is none.
Well,
we're just lumped now into entertainer. Same category that clowns use.
Well, I could see why there wouldn't be workers' comp, because you're independent contractor of sorts. You don't really have an employer per se.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. If you work for Circus Circus, or you get hired by...
Oh, that's ongoing.
Right. I mean, if you're there used to be a musicians union. There is still, to some degree, a musicians union in various cities, like, you know, San Francisco Symphony and New York Phil and Chicago Phil and L.A. Phil and so on and so on. They're all union musicians, okay? But there's no workers' comp code for just musician. You're just an entertainer, you know, so... There used to be, sort of, because
sort of kind of in a way.
They didn't have workers' comp back in the 40s and 50s.
No, they didn't.
They didn't exist. You know, that's kind of a new thing, but we didn't even get a code.
My grandfather, you know? When the Social Security came out,
right.
He said, oh, yeah, we get paid to be hobos. And my grandmother said, no, you're going back to work.
Yes, exactly. So for the repair industry, because there really isn't an entertainer industry anymore, to be a professional musician is really difficult. You know, you can go get a degree in music, and what are you going to do with it? Where are you going to go work? You know, clubs don't really pay any money, so you go out to teach. And so here in the United, in other countries like in Europe, I mean, I took a trip to Germany to the trade show in Frankfurt. I invented a product called Godor Bell, which I got stacks of boxes over here. Been working on this for about 10 years. We're in Sky Mall right now. Little plug here. We're going to be in Hamacher Schlemmer for the fall Christmas catalog.
No way.
Yes, serious. It's going to be great. We're so excited about this.
Wow.
But anyways, I took the product to Frankfurt for the trade show over there, and we did pretty well. But I noticed that there was an active music culture in Germany. There were clubs where musicians, everybody was loved the music, and every place was filled, and there's lots of different kinds of music, and there was jazz and blues and rock and pop and everything you can imagine, and there's a lot of support for the arts. And in Europe in general, I got the vibe was that they really support music education. You have to take a music class all the way up through eighth grade, and then after that it's an option when you're in high school. But K through eight, you get a music class. And I think that's really important, especially in the United States. We need to have that because it teaches people something that I think is really critically important, and that is how to listen, how to use your hands and to think at the same time. So, you know, the act of playing music with other musicians. So think about the things that we have to do, right? Okay. So we have to have some mechanical skills on the instrument. We have to know where the notes are when we're looking at the page too. You know, we're looking at the notes on the page. So we have to translate what we're seeing into what we're doing with our hands. We have to look ahead of the music so we know what's coming up. And while we're playing the music, we have to be listening to the musicians next to us on the other side, left and right, so that we're in the same place in time as they are. That's where we get the phrase being on the same page, right?
Multi-level ambidextry.
Yes, it is. It's we're thinking on all these different levels. We're listening to the other musicians. We're listening to what we're playing. We're looking at the music, translating those little dots on the page into something that makes that is music. And we're doing this all at the same time. And so we have to work together harmoniously. So if you take that skill set away, if you take that education away from kids as they grow up, they never learn how to be on the same page with another group of people. So how can we function as a society if is as growing up we don't have that ability to connect with other people? You know, we don't have that experience. You don't get that from sports. You don't get that from tackling people on the football field or running, which is solo. You know, sports are great activities, I think, really important because it keeps your body healthy and so forth. But as a mental exercise, I can't undervalue or underestimate the importance of music education in young people because it teaches us a critically important skill, which is listening and communicating and working with other people at the same time on a non-competitive level.
Well, and just listening to music generally. I was very fortunate that my parents each had very diverse musical tastes.
Yeah.
So I was exposed to classical because my mom played piano. There's classical, old country and western, you know,
right.
Sons of the Pioneers, and, you know, all the old country to the 50s rock. My dad had a brief stint as a DJ in the 50s. And
oh, cool. So you had a record collection.
It was a variety. He had an alligator case.
Oh, nice.
That he stole some of the records from when he left the station. So I was very blessed, which I didn't realize until I was older, of course, that I had that exposure on a daily basis. In fact, I tell people once in a while, and they say, oh, you know, your dad, your parents probably listen to this old boring music. I said,
no, none of it was
actually,
boring.
One of my dad's favorite songs was Riders on the Storm.
Oh, great. Oh, it was a great song. I love it. It just has a cool vibe to it. You know what I mean? The guitar has a great tone to it. Yeah, that's great stuff.
So I think that that is a major factor in your awareness, heightened awareness of music. If you are exposed to a variety of music, so you're already a few steps ahead of the game.
Right.
So then when you start playing a musical instrument, then it just raises it even higher.
Of course. Right. Yeah, of course. Now, this is an interesting thing. So picture in your mind that song Riders on the Storm, okay? I'll bet that when you hear that music, it transports you back in time, and you can then again see in your mind's eye all the things that were going on in your life at that time.
Of course.
Right? Of course. So one of the things that's so interesting about music and why I'm fascinated with it is actually the netting that we drape our memories on. Okay? So I know for most people, and maybe for everyone if you really inquire enough, if you play music throughout the course of their lifespan, it'll bring, like maybe smells too, but music in particular, if you play a piece of music for someone that they heard when they were 10, they can immediately remember what was going on at the time, who they were with, what the days were like, if it was sunny or raining or something like that. We attach memories and events to the music that we heard at the time.
They're using it now with Alzheimer's and dementia patients.
To give them dementia? Or,
or yes, give them dementia.
Because
Dave,
it's made me demented.
Dave.
So there's a couple of songs that have made me demented, I got to tell you.
Because as you were saying earlier, if something happened when they're 10 and they had a joyous memory of that particular song, so they found that you may have a patient who basically spends 24/7 just hunched over, and they put the earphones on, and it triggers.
There was a film about this.
Yes, exactly.
What was the name of
it? I was trying
to
remember the name of it also, but it's music therapy, and it's phenomenal. And when I first saw a clip from that movie, I thought, well, of course, like, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I remember it was a film about, I think it was a woman who was the first music therapist. She was trying to get there was a young man, I guess, he was very autistic or something. I can't remember the details of it, but no one believed that she had, and she played rock and roll for him, some kind of rock and roll records, and for whatever reason, it broke this kid out of his sort of trance. He was able to communicate again. That was a really fascinating film, and the research that she did was pretty amazing too. But I'm so interested in how all this works, and you know, my contribution to society is, you know, making instruments go and getting people involved in music, because I personally feel like it's very important in our lives. And so this is just my contribution to society.
Well, it's another language of expression.
Yeah, it brings people together.
Not everyone is verbally articulate.
Yes,
and they need the I can't remember when it was, but I saw that in this interview with Santana, and he talked about how disappointed these women would be because they'd see him on the stage just really working.
Right, right.
The instrument, but didn't transfer as well into the bedroom. He says your guitar is not the same.
No, it isn't, unfortunately.
Because I disappointed so many women.
Well, you know, that is the problem, because especially if you've got gigs booked back to back, you can get distracted because you're thinking about this tune that you've got that you're trying to work out, and it's very unfortunate. But you know, the thing is that, and I'm, you know, I'm sure Mr. Santana would agree with me on this, is that music is one of the few things that draws every culture and society together. You know, you put 10,000 people in a stadium and you put a great band on that bandstand. It doesn't matter if it's a salsa band or a rock band or a blues band. If they're great, if they're really good, everybody's into it. Everybody has a good time. It doesn't matter what your background is. And we need that as a civilization.
It unifies
us, and right now the world is flying apart at record speed. You know, there's just trouble all over the place, and a lot of it is, you know, and I don't really want to get into politics, but it's just some really bad decision making at the top levels.
Really?
Yeah. And
if there wasn't, I don't think the Daily Show would have anything to report.
I know. I thank God for John Stewart. I love those guys. But you know, and so I mean, I have ideas about how to change all that, and at some other time we could talk about a different story. But music is one of the things that brings cultures together, and good food, and maybe some beer.
You're putting that last.
Right, exactly.
I'm disappointed.
But one of the things that I put on my box, my Godora Bell box, is a trademark that I got. I woke up in the middle of the night, and I realized that this is what my little thing does. When you came in the front door, that thing strummed, and that is, open the door to music, and music will open doors. You could not speak the same language as somebody else, but if you have an instrument in your hand, you played something and they played too, you can communicate even though you guys don't speak the same language or even from the same culture.
I backpacked across Europe when I was 19, and on the ship we met a couple of people, a couple of guys, an Egyptian and an Ethiopian.
Right.
And the Ethiopian had brought a guitar.
Right.
And he could play Chuck Berry, the Beatles.
Isn't that interesting?
He knew all these 50 songs.
Right.
It was fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved it. It was very cool.
Exactly.
It was so unexpected, especially from a 19-year-old's perspective, when you think that your hometown is the entire world.
Right.
And just generally traveling to the countries and
right.
cultures, but to have this very specific, isolated, narrow commonality was just
yeah.
really cool.
Oh, I had a very similar eye-opening experience. Years ago, and this is another different story too, my dad taught Russian history when I was a kid, and so I decided that I was going to go to Moscow and see the Kremlin, right? And Goom, and the whole... I wanted to see where the tanks rolled, okay? I wanted to see all that. I wanted to see Catherine the Great's carriage. And so I made a trip over there, and one of the things I found out was that they worshipped the Beatles. And I was stunned because they knew all the songs, and they knew the whole history of the band. And then when I came back just a few years later, KVI, Channel 6 broadcast a show that they had, Channel 6, that PBS had produced, about how it was I forget what the name of the show is, but it was how the Beatles brought down the Kremlin. And the entire show was about the history of what happened. And so the Beatles would be broadcasting out of Germany. Okay, they were playing in the cellar. And there were some bootleg underground recordings of the band and some of the recordings they've been working on. And what people would do is, on the other side of the border, they would record the music on like X-ray film sheets, this foldable or the flexible plastic. They would, you know, lay it on a disc and they'd etch it just like a regular LP. It was cut, you know, on plastic, but they could roll it up. Huh. And they'd put it in the sleeves of their coats. And so when they'd go, because the Beatles' music was forbidden in Russia because it undermined the control of the party. And so they would smuggle in these Beatles records. And then what they'd do is they'd start reprinting them underground. And if you haven't seen it, you've got to look it up. You can probably find it on YouTube. But they interviewed some of the members of the ruling government that are very high up in you know, Russian politics. And they said, when we were young men, we were swayed from the party by the Beatles because we realized that there was hope out there. And that's how that they said more than anything else, more than sanctions, more than bombs, more than wars, it was the Beatles changing the mentality of the Russian people, which collapsed the Soviet Union and brought down the USSR. Hmm. Now it's the Russian, now it's the Russian Republic. And I thought that was amazing. Music did that. Four guys singing about love and happiness, and you know, wanting to hold hands. And I mean, that changed an entire nation. And so, in music, and you know, especially that kind of that elevated emotional stuff, that's what changes the world. I think it brings people together instead of separates them, and that's why we need that more than anything else. You know,
absolutely. So you probably have all sorts of ages and stories that come through here.
Oh, of course.
You should have a book for that.
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm working. It's one of the many projects I'm working on. I've been working on a music theory book for quite a long time. I went to City College for a couple of years, and then I was fortunate I got to go to Berklee School of Music in Boston for a year. One of the teachers I had there was an amazing guy named Brett Wilmot, and he kind of unlocked everything that I had been working on, put all the pieces of how the fingerboard worked together for me. But it was complicated how he explained it. And I sell his books here. They're published through Mel Bay. And his book is, it's like an inch thick. And you open it up and the first page is just dense with code and scrolling. And it's not easy to read through. And so I kind of filtered it. And I'm working on a much simplified version of explaining the same way.
Get to the point,
right. Because once it finally dawned on me how chords work on the fingerboard of the guitar, and I still struggle with it, you know, but it changed everything for me. I was actually able to play songs the way I wanted to play them. I knew how things fit together. And so I teach that in my class here, and a lot of the other teachers have picked up on it too. And then I have really fortunate to have all these amazing teachers here, Doug Pauly and Greg Williams and Noakes Kelly and Tyson Graff and Melissa Collard and our newest teacher, Allison Yaffe. She plays guitar in Cave Women. She just came back from 3 weeks at Banff Canada to jazz mm-hmm. camp, and just stellar talent I have in this little shop, you know? And so I always surround myself with people that are better than I am, and it makes
me
look good.
That's what successful people do.
Yeah. It's
what's some general info that newbies should know? Like you need to find a guitar that fits you.
Well, you know, you can play any size guitar, really. I mean, it's not so much the size of the guitar. You can reach your arm around pretty much anything, you know, because the neck is the business end. But there's different body sizes, you know. I think most importantly is you have to spend some money to buy a decent instrument. If you're just going out to buy the cheapest guitar you can buy because you're not sure whether you're going to like it or not, you're going to lose because it's going to sound bad, it's going to play bad, it'll be an unpleasant experience, and for sure you'll put it down because it's not enjoyable. So if you buy a nice instrument, you know, I mean, spend $300 or $400 or $500 minimum and get something that works pretty well, you know. I mean, the parts are good, it's going to stay in tune, and have a shop set it up because they're not always adjusted. In fact, they're rarely adjusted in that price range to function properly. They're just built and shipped out the door, and everything coming from that price range is either coming from China or Indonesia. You know, the upper end stuff is now, if you get something made in Korea, that's higher end stuff. If you get something made in Japan, that's going to be really expensive, and American made stuff is going to be real high end. But the more money you spend, the better the guitar is going to be. And the other benefit is that if you decide that you don't want to play it, it's going to be easier to sell it. You know, you've got some value to it, but you're going to have a lot better experience buying a quality guitar. You're going to be, and if it's pretty, and if you buy something that you like to look at, you're going to want to pick it up. Every time I open up the case to my Les Paul, I put my hands over my mouth and I go, "Oh my goodness, that's my guitar! I get to play this every time." You know, it's just great. It just sucks me in every time. There's just something great looking about those guitars, you know. So it, you know, it helps fuel the obsession with it. You know, it's fun. Tonight I get to play with a bunch of my friends, and I get to have all my toys out there, and you know, I can pretend I'm Keith Richards and I'm playing with, I'm, you know, backing up Mick Jagger and Lisa Fisher, and you know, we get to rock and roll while people are swilling their wine, you know. And that's ultimately the fun, you know. That's more fun than anything else, is hanging out with your friends and playing music.
that is life.
That is the best part of life, you know.
What's the best venue that you've played at? Outdoors parks?
Actually, the biggest venue I've ever played at was, I got a call from some of the folks at Skip's Music. I forget who it was that called, but a group had come in to for the Cal Expo, for the state fair, and the guitarist's wife had gone into labor, and he had to fly back to Utah right away, and they needed a guitar player that could read, and there was only a couple of guys in town that could pull the gig off, and Henry Robinette got the first call, but he was booked for that night, and so they got a hold of me, and it was the Osmond Brothers. So I said, well, how much does it pay? And then I said, oh, okay. So I said, well, sure. So the show was on, actually, they were playing on a Monday, and they had come into Sacramento Saturday night and were at one of the hotels up there by the fair, and Red Lion or something, I think. And so I met them Sunday morning at the hotel and got their book, you know, a big ring binder with all the charts and two CDs. And went home and I shedded for about 6 hours, looked at all their charts, and went over to, you know, to Cal Expo for the show, and I was brought to the trailer, and I was made an honorary Osmond. And so as we're walking to the stage, women tried to touch me. They were like grabbing for the brothers, you know what I mean? And I just happened to be there, like, oh, you know, and I thought, this is the weirdest thing I've ever experienced. I'm the tool guy. I got the guitar in my hands, you know. But it was really fun. It was a great show. You know, I had the Jumbotron up there, and there had to be 10,000 people. It was packed.
Fun.
And so the way it works is, and Donnie was playing drums, and he was great. And so the way the show works is there's a click track, you know. So Donnie's got earpiece, and he's got the controller on bandstand. So, you know, he starts, it's a sequence. And so the way that works is he's playing to a click, and during that there's some pre-recorded music playing through the monitors with the band, but all the vocals, the bass part, the guitar, that's all live, but some of the keyboard parts are sequenced, and all the lights and all the video are clocked to the sequence. So that way the whole event comes across, all the lighting changes and all the images on the big screen, that's all connected to the groove of the tune. And so we get to hear the click through Donnie playing the drums. He sets the tempo for the show. And so, you know, I started on page one and played for an hour and 15 minutes and just kept turning the pages, and that was fun. And then I got a nice big check. And that was the biggest venue I've ever played.
Anyone, your dream musician that you would like to just hang out and jam with? Not necessarily concert, just jam.
Pat Metheny.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was just here in town. I didn't get to see him play at a rehearsal that night, but he is like the Bach of our time. He is amazing. He's so prolific, and everything he writes is beautiful. He's an amazing guy. You know, he's an inventor. He invented these sort of automated robot solenoid-driven things that play bottles and bells and drums, and he's just a fascinating character, and he writes beautiful stuff. Yeah, he's one of the guys I'd like to hang out with. I had always wanted to play with Miles Davis. Never got to play with Miles Davis. But there's other guys out there, too. Kurt Rosenwinkel, you know, Ben Street. There's a lot of good musicians out there. I'd love to play with Herbie Hancock.
That'd experimental.
Yeah, he's just a great piano player. You know, he's amazing, you know. And there's not many of those legendary players left, you know, they're disappearing. I'd love to jam with the Stones, you know, that would be something else. I'd love to play Gimme Shelter with them, and I want Lisa on the bandstand too.
Okay.
That's the girl singer, you know. Oh my goodness. So yeah, there's lots of dreams, you know, but you know, in the meantime, I've got the shop going here, and I'm very, very fortunate to do something that I really like to do. Not many people get to do that.
And you've created an item that's going to be in Hammock or Slumber.
Hammock or Slumber. Oh, you know, the possibility of this taking off, Godore Bell, is there. And, you know, I mean, ultimately, I'd love to court Disney, you know. Because I heard this thing. This is great. You know, I Twitter Godore Bell stuff. And that's, I drive people to the Godore Bell website because they see my logo, the G Godore Bell logo. And apparently, Disney has a contest. They're looking for the eighth dwarf, the eighth minor, right? Because the dwarves are minors, right? Name the eighth minor. And so when I look at what the dwarves are, I thought, well, shouldn't they have a girl minor? Where's Clementine? Remember, was a minor 49er? and you know, this Clementine song. But then they sing that song, "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's mm-hmm. off to work I go," okay? But none of the miners play an instrument. And what are the dwarfs' names? What are they?
Oh, I can't. I'm always missed. There's like one or two I always
there's, right, there's
miss.
Like Dumpy and I don't
Dumpy,
know.
Dumpy, yeah, one, that's the first one.
Dumpy and Goofy. You know, not Goofy because he's the other guy.
Yeah.
Right. But they're all
you in. You can be on the other team when we go on a game show.
Right, okay, the other team, right. I'm not Jeopardy, right. But I thought, well, what if one of them was, what if the new one was a guitar player? Because all those miners, you know, the guys from the gold miners, they always had a guitar around somewhere.
Or a uke
or something like that. But
that might be by their size.
Right, exactly. Well, shouldn't they have a dwarf named Picky, the guitar playing?
Okay.
Right? I don't know. I just put that out there. So, you know, because then they'd have a product to sell. They could sell the doorbell and have a guy named... Anyway, I'm really stretching it out there, but, you know, that would set Guitar Workshop up for life. I could get a bigger store and more lesson rooms and a recording facility, and we could expand. It's just so many things to do.
That's good to have a lot of interests and projects.
Yeah, yeah. I've got more patents on the way.
Nice.
Yes.
Stay tuned. Literally.
Yes.
By the way, his invention he mentioned, Git Doorbell, that's GUIT Doorbell, which will be appearing in Hammacher Schlemmer, is a fully functional one-half size acoustic guitar, which is mounted over an inward opening doorway with a striker. So when the door opens, the guitar strums. In my continuing highlighting of national parks, I'm heading over to Washington, San Juan Island National Historic Park, one of the last natural prairies in the Puget Sound Northern Straits region of Washington. It's a popular getaway choice. It also has an interesting bit of history. In 1859, a crisis occurred between the United States and Great Britain when a pig owned by British-owned Hudson's Bay Company was shot by U.S. citizen Lyman Cutler for rooting in his potato patch. It resulted in an international incident, commonly referred to as the Pig War. The poor pig was its only casualty. It's unknown who actually ate it. As you might expect, there's an English camp and an American camp. The oldest structure on the island is the American camp's officers' quarters, built in 1859-60. Northwest Indian tribes prized the island's creamy potato baked pear tasting camas bulbs. In fact, people traveled great distances for the bulbs, and groups sometimes fought over the best growing areas. The San Juan Islands have the largest concentration of bald eagles in the continental United States. And as you ride the ferry through the islands toward San Juan Island, you can see and feel what draws them there. There are more than 6 miles of public shoreline, hiking trails through woodlands, prairie, and uplands. Along the Pacific Flyway, the park provides temporary homes for more than 200 species of migratory birds. Here's something for all you trivia hotshots. Actually, you probably already know this, but it's a fun little historical trivia story. This is from Thomas Ayer's book, That's Not in My American History Book. On a crisp October afternoon in Atlanta in 1916, Georgia Tech's powerful football team took the field against Little Cumberland College in a gridiron contest that rewrote the record books and became a footnote in sports history. No one expected Cumberland to win the game. Georgia Tech had one of the most powerful teams in the nation that year, but no one anticipated the massacre that took place. Fate had lined up against the Cumberland football team even before it reached Atlanta. With only 16 players on its roster, the team stopped over in Nashville to recruit some ringers from the Vanderbilt football squad. The stop cost Cumberland 3 of its best players, who were stranded in Nashville when they missed the train to Atlanta. As the game got underway, Georgia Tech's running backs scored at will. By halftime, Tech had run over, through, and around Cumberland's hapless defense for 19 touchdowns and led by an unbelievable score of 126-0. But that was not good enough for the Georgia Tech coach. During the halftime break, he was inspired to give his team a pep talk. "Men, we might be in front," he warned his players, "but you never know what those Cumberland players have up their sleeves." All the Cumberland players had up their sleeves were bruises in abundance and a collective desire to get out of the stadium alive. But there was no mercy in the hearts of the Georgia Tech players. Several of them had been on the Tech baseball team that was humiliated when Cumberland upset them the previous spring. Inspired by their coach, the Tech players stormed back onto the field and ran up another 96 points in the second half. The final score was 222-0, a record that still stands. By the time the Cumberland players limped off the field, Tech running backs had rolled up 528 yards rushing, 220 on kickoff returns, and another 220 on punt returns. Tech did not even throw a pass in the game. Upon learning about the halftime pep talk when his team was leading 126-0, sports writers were at least as unmerciful in their criticism of the coach as he had been in running up the score on poor Cumberland College. They labeled the Georgia Tech mentor, "Ole Shut the Gates of Mercy." The name and game would haunt him for the remainder of his coaching career. In fact, his name became synonymous with one who runs up the score on an overmatched opponent. But in spite of his merciless reputation, the Tech coach would go on to achieve greatness and forever leave his imprint on the game. He was the man responsible for dividing football games into four quarters instead of two halves. He invented the center snap direct to the quarterback. He set up the first collegiate athlete dormitory for football players. He was the one who devised the formations that would become the T and the I, variations of which are still used by college and professional coaches. And the Georgia Tech coach would achieve one other noteworthy distinction. In 1935, it was decided that a trophy should be awarded to the most outstanding collegiate football player in the nation each year. Over the years, it became one of the most prestigious individual awards in all of sports. It was called the Heisman Trophy, and it became the ultimate symbol for football excellence. The trophy was named for John Heisman, the same Georgia Tech coach who once shut the gates of mercy on Little Cumberland College. So, there you go. Do something different. Master a tough tongue twister. In other words, not something simple like how much wood can a woodchuck